Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Em Varger of her podcast, Hate Read, and we're going to be discussing Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard Book, winner of the 2009 Hugo Award for Best Novel, and also a Newbery Medal winner. I can say that. Nobody has to know I screwed it up the first time. So, Em, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think I found you guys on Twitter, and you had tweeted out about They'd Rather Be Right, which is one of the Hugo winners.
I think you actually found us on Reddit, because we talked about...
Right.
We were doing our podcasting thing. And
that's right.
Yeah, you mentioned that you're going to have to read They'd Rather Be Right, which is one of the first ones we covered. My co-host, Anna, the format of our podcast is that it's me and my co-host, Anna, who's also my sister-in-law, and we challenge each other to read a book that sounds like it's something we would hate, and then we talk about it for about an hour. So far, they've all been ones that we pretty much hate.
Right.
we keep hoping that one of them's going to surprise us and like expand our horizons, but it hasn't really happened yet. But we read They'd Rather Be Right by Mark Clifton for, I think it was our second episode.
Yeah, that sounds right.
But yeah, so you mentioned that you're going to have to read that. And yeah, then we kind of got to talking and here I am.
Excellent. And I really do enjoy your podcast.
Thank you.
It sounds like the kind of thing I would hate to do because I, you know, funny thing is I like to enjoy the things I read. And so setting out to do things that I think I would hate, it seems like it would be soul crushing. But then listening to you guys, it's like a therapy session when you get together and talk about it.
And it's so,
yeah.
On the one hand, I totally get people who say like, I don't want to hate read stuff.
Right.
Because yeah, you should read things that you like. But I'm one of those people who kind of enjoys hate watching stuff. And there's this communal element to that. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen The Room, but there's that whole like cult following behind that. And I love it. It's so great to just talk to people about, you know, oh, hi, Mark, and all that sort of thing. But you don't really get that with books. You don't have that communal sort of, this was a bad book and we're going to talk about how bad it is. And it's kind of that, like that whole quote that, you know, all perfect families are perfect in the same way, but bad families are, you know, monstrous in their own way, that sort of thing. There's so much to talk about why things don't work in books or why things don't work for us. Because a lot of it isn't, this is a bad book. It's, you know, this didn't work for me. I didn't like this for this reason. Right. So it also kind of gets, you get to talk about yourself a little bit and it's fun.
Like, yeah. Well, and I'm sure you get some feedback from people who are like, hey, I liked that book, you know?
Oh, yeah. One of our most recent ones. Sorry to keep cutting you off.
No, go for it.
One of our most recent ones, the Jojo Moyes book, Me Before You, you know, it's a hugely popular book.
Yes.
It just, again, it didn't work for us for various reasons, which you can find out by listening to that episode.
Yes, I liked the way you approached it, where you're like, and then the book ends and, you know, that's fine. And then you're like, no, it doesn't actually end there. And this is part of the problem. So, yeah, good stuff. And I like, you know, as we've interacted on Twitter and I've kind of expressed that I appreciate your podcast because it's one of those ones where I feel like I don't have to do the homework for this. I can just listen in and find out, you know, kind of what they think about it. And lots of the titles, I'm like, I wouldn't read that anyway. And so I'm just going to listen in because you guys are fun to listen to. So
yeah, some podcasts like this podcast, when I found that something, this is great, I'm going to start reading along to these books because these are books that I would want to read. I don't want to make our listeners feel like they need to read these books. I don't think that would be fun for everyone.
Yes. Let the hate flow through you.
right.
Nice. Well, we were talking before we started recording about, you know, kind of history as a nerdy type. And I don't know to what extent you consider yourself nerdy or geeky or any of that. Yeah. So why don't you talk about that a bit and some of your personal history.
I do consider myself a nerd. I would say that I skew more towards fantasy than sci-fi on like the spectrum of speculative fiction. And I probably got started reading fantasy, like middle school years, probably. I was really into Gail Carson Levine and the Chronicles of Prydain, which I honestly probably pronounced wrong. But
No, that's correct.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, I read those when I was in grade school, you know.
Oh my gosh, they're so good.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then I was of the age that I was a child when Harry Potter was coming out, and suddenly everybody else was into fantasy books all of a sudden. And it was great. And it was so much fun. But then, you know, we got kind of older and that kind of started falling off.
Yes. So, I understand.
But then once I got into kind of college years, I started reading more sci-fi, but I tend to read more short sci-fi, like short stories and novellas and things like that. Whereas if it's a series, I still skew more towards fantasy. I don't know why. I just feel like I can put up with fantasy for longer than I feel like sci-fi, because it's kind of supposed to be something that could happen, sort of. When it gets to that longer, larger scale, I feel like my suspension of disbelief gets broken more easily. So fantasy works more for me for longer fiction.
And science fiction can be different too, because there's that hard science fiction kind of stuff where if you're into that, that's great. But if you're not, it can really be a turnoff. Where there's, I've covered a variety of books on this podcast, and there's a lot of them that are just much more, hey, here's my science fiction concept. Now we're going to build story off of it. And that a lot of times makes an easier read than something that's like the story is the nuts and bolts. So,
Yeah, definitely.
Well, so talking about that, I had asked you to tally up the number of Hugo winners you'd read.
And I think my final tally ended up being about 12.
Okay.
Which, yeah, I was like, more than I thought, but there were definitely a ton on there that I had to read for a class.
Oh, interesting.
So I was like, I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure if that counts, but we're going
to. Yes. I read it in terms of if I was asked that I had read it.
I was forced to read it.
Well, the funny thing is 12 was the number I started at. When I looked at the list initially, I thought, wow, I need to read more of these. And then thought, well, how about I do a podcast? So I'm now at 24. I've doubled my original total.
Nice.
And, you know, I've had other guests who have read, you know, in single digits or all the way up to my last guest had read all but four of them. So,
oh my God.
So when we were originally kind of talking about this on Reddit, you know, you said, well, hey, I can come on and we can talk about They'd Rather Be Right. But I didn't want to make you, you know, go back to one that you didn't like. And I'm going to have to cover it eventually.
I wanted to spare someone else.
Right. And I have my friend that I have another podcast with, he's volunteered to cover that one with me. So I thought, why don't you pick something that you actually enjoy or one that you want to read? So why the Graveyard book?
Okay, so there were a couple of Neil Gaiman books on here, and, you know, kind of talking about my nerd history, I wouldn't say Neil Gaiman's like my favorite author or anything like that, but he has a big place in my heart because he was kind of one of the first adult fantasy writers that I ended up reading, because he had Stardust, which was targeted towards YA, and I read that early high school years, and I was like, oh, I like him, I'm going to read more of his stuff, so then I read American Gods. So he was kind of like one of the first, I guess, serious adult writers that I got into, and I did not choose American Gods because I don't think that I could properly cover that, because I would just be like squeeing about it too much, and that would just be embarrassing for everyone.
Nice.
So I went with Graveyard Book, which I love a little less. But I, you know, it's still a good book. I still like it. And I'd read it when it first came out several years ago, and I hadn't read it since then. So I was like, this will be great. I'll get to reread this book. Like I need an excuse to reread a book.
Right.
But yeah. And I thought, you know, it'd be a fun time.
Well, yeah. For me, in terms of like, I have two podcasts where I have to read books. And so rereading a book is a real luxury. And so I like it when somebody picks one that I've already read on the list, which isn't that many of them. So, and this was not one of them. This was a first time read for me.
All right.
So why don't we go ahead and move into talking more about this book in particular?
Absolutely.
So can you give kind of a quick non-spoiler synopsis of the book?
Yeah, sure. So if you've read The Jungle Book, it's the first three chapters of that, but with ghosts instead of wolves. And that's pretty much it. No, it's about a young boy we don't know his name at first, a young boy whose family is killed in suspicious circumstances. He escapes from this massacre and ends up in a graveyard where he is adopted by some ghosts, and then he grows up in the graveyard, learning to be a living person amongst the dead.
Right. That's a good synopsis. I like it. Now, I have not read The Jungle Book. You know, I saw the movie when I was a kid, the animated movie.
Yeah, which is also great. I've talked about this on my own podcast. I'm kind of a Disney nerd too, which is honestly probably the worst type of nerd, but
I don't know, all the nerd properties are being gathered into Disney now, so
yeah, they're, well, that's part of it, because it's like the whole nerd zeitgeist is we're kind of on the edges of things, and Disney is so mainstream that it's like it's nerdy but it's undercut by it anyway.
Yeah, so you can be a nerd hipster, you know, and eschew all that kind of stuff. Yeah,
right. But yeah, it's the Jungle Book, the book, the Rudyard Kipling book, is pretty similar in broad strokes to the Disney movie, except that it is not told in chronological order. It's a series of short stories instead of kind of an overall plot. And only the first three short stories actually are what's in most adaptations of the Jungle Book, the story about Mowgli. The rest of it, there's a story about a white seal that finds a home for all the other seals. There's a story about a elephant trainer. There's a story about animals in the army. And there's a story about Rikki Tikki Tavi, which is the other kind of famous one, which is about a mongoose who kills snakes. Yeah. It's a great short animated movie from the 1970s also.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember that, so.
That was one we got from Blockbuster many a time.
Nice.
But yeah, so the stuff that's covered in this book is pretty much the Mowgli stuff. There's references to other stuff from the Jungle Book, but it's mainly the Mowgli stuff. And I like the Rudyard Kipling book. It's interesting. It's not as horribly racist as it could have been, being from that era and like that topic of white guy living in India, writing about India.
Right.
It has its moments, but you know. But yeah, it's a cute little book. I really, really enjoy, also this is another reason why I kind of picked this book, and something that Neil Gaiman does a lot, is I really like books that are adaptations, I guess, of other stuff.
Gotcha.
I like to see how different authors handle different subjects and how things change over time and what sort of things become kind of more, like what themes would emerge in a modern version of the Jungle Book versus the Jungle Book that was written in the 1800s, you know? So I really, like, a lot of people don't like to read adaptations because they're like, oh no, the first one's the best and it's the best and it's the good one and we're going to do that forever.
it's funny that you should mention that, because my other podcast is all about adapted science fiction. And one of my co-hosts and I are just constantly arguing about, you know, he wants to see a movie that's the exact copy of the book. And I want to see something that takes,
I
want to see something that takes risks.
Exactly. I'm like, it's a different medium.
Yes.
It's, you know, why are you doing the exact same thing? I don't like one-to-one adaptations. I like adaptations that change stuff and shake it up. And I think making the animals into ghosts shook it up enough.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the other part, and sorry, jumping in here, is embarrassing confessions time, I never made the connection to the Jungle Book until I saw someone else writing about it. And then I'm looking at it, I'm like, literally the title is just pull out jungle and put in graveyard.
Yes.
So that's a little humiliating, but on the other hand,
I don't know if you would make that connection, because the Jungle Book is not that big of it's not a huge part of the current cultural zeitgeist, you know?
I think I do have it on a bookshelf somewhere around here though. So.
Well, I can't make excuses for you anymore, Seth. Get it together.
But on the other hand, it also works well on its own. You know, you don't have to have that background for it. And I did want to talk to you about, you know, did you feel like that enhanced your enjoyment of the Graveyard Book? Because I'm sure there were references that I missed.
Yeah, I think the first time I read it, I had not read the entire Jungle Book. I'd read the section Ka's Hunting, which is the section on Mowgli being kidnapped by the Bandarlog, which are monkeys, and having to be saved, which in this book, this is getting a little spoilery, but there's a section that parallels that. Yeah. We'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
And so I got that reference when I read it the first time because I'd read that short story. Because again, the original Jungle Book is really a collection of short stories.
Yeah.
Kind of held together by a similar theme. But I definitely enjoyed reading it now where I have read the whole Jungle Book and picking up different things. But I don't think it's necessary at all. I feel like the enjoyment I got out of it was kind of the same sort of enjoyment of just rereading it, where you get to pick up on things that you didn't notice before, you know?
Yeah, I will say I really enjoyed it. I wasn't
good.
I wasn't sure that I would, because Gaiman is I won't say hit or miss for me, because something like American mm-hmm. Gods, I can recognize that it's really, really good. But there's something about his prose and something about me not being such a fantasy fan that I feel like there's times where he's writing something, he's describing it, and I cannot picture it.
Yes.
And in particular, American Gods, I think I pretty much, you know, understood all of that to the mm-hmm. extent that it's understandable. But Anansi Boys, I remember reading that one. I'm like, I have no idea what's going on at the moment. And it's kind of even, doesn't it kind of fit in with American Gods, that book?
Yeah, it's a
kind of a side
spin-off of one of the characters, his okay. sons, essentially.
Yeah, and so yeah. so I was a little concerned that this could be a factor in this book.
Mm.
But I think the fact that it's written for a slightly younger audience made it,
it
helped a bit. There were a couple times where I thought, I'm not quite sure what I'm picturing here.
Yeah, especially, I don't know if this might have been one of the things you, I wanted to ask you, because I know you've read the graphic novel version, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I cannot picture how this freaking graveyard is supposed to be laid out. They talk right. about going from this place to that place so many times. I'm like, I don't know what this place looks like.
I know it in the book, it makes it sound like it's, you know, the size of a small city.
Yes.
So the graphic novel, I think, does kind of present it as sort of a strip through the town almost, with hills and kind of some geography to it. So, but like I said, that wasn't really a factor here. And the graphic novel actually really did kind of help set kind of some of the things I was seeing. It's good and bad,
yeah.
right? Where this is someone else's interpretation of what I should be seeing. And so
right.
it's training wheels kind of, but I did right, enjoy it.
But like, I feel with a lot of his writing, like you said, it is kind of hard to picture yeah. exactly just what he's talking about, because he writes about stuff in kind of a roundabout mm-hmm. way, which can be great and good writing, but also when it comes to kind of the, I don't want to say minutia, because that makes it sound like I'm downplaying sure. this, but kind of like the little details of just the world building. I definitely yeah. agree. I think it can be kind of hard to actually figure out what the heck he's talking about.
That is heartening for me, because I thought it's just me. It's yeah. a defect in my reading comprehension.
No, so. it's not just okay. you. But I mean, like, for me, that sort of thing is kind of fun
yeah.
because I like having that kind of thing being like withheld. I mm-hmm. like not getting the full, which he does a lot of that. Right. He does that in the plot of this at a few points. And I like that, but I definitely see how it could be not for everyone, yeah. you know?
Well, and I'm imagining it would reward a reread as well, because there's things that you'd get at different
yeah.
parts in your, different times in your life too. And particularly like you were talking about the Prydain Chronicles, right? So I read these in, 1982 when I was, 11 years old. And
right.
and then I came back and I read them as an adult and just loved them. Just and it gave me that feeling of being a kid again. But then I read them to my son when he was young, and
oh.
and so you get to appreciate them from a completely different level
right.
there. And that's one thing that I like about young adult fiction, is that you can kind of
yeah.
if it's something that you grew up with, or if it's something that you're reading to a child, you see it from kind of two different ways, and there's different kind of poignant things
yeah.
that happen based on that. So, and we can get more into that later. So if you were going to recommend this novel to someone, on kind of on what basis would you recommend it? You know, if they like, on different author, other books, movies.
Yeah. Kind of, I keep bringing this up, but kind of if you're into that retelling sort of book, Mercedes Lackey sort of does a lot of that. I mentioned Gail Carson Levine, which is a YA one, but if you were into Gail Carson Levine as a kid, the sort of authors who are, or, who's the one? Madeline Miller, Song of Achilles, if anybody's read that one.
I've seen it, but haven't read it.
Yeah, recommend.
Okay.
but any of those type of books, if you're into that sort of adaptation sort of narrative, you'd probably be into this.
Right.
Also, obviously, if you're a Gaiman fan already and you haven't happened to read this one, it's pretty in line, I'd say, with most of his other work. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge curveball. I'm trying to think of who else would be. Do you have any?
I was just thinking that if you like kind of young adult, but maybe not too young adult, because,
yeah.
there's some mature themes here, certainly. One of the series that I enjoyed reading to my son when he was younger was the Gregor the Overlander series. And that kind of has, a child taken into to a different kind of world as well.
Oh, okay.
So similar themes and that kind of thing, but And also, it's young adult, but not too young adult, because those books get really
right.
violent because they're, they're battling 6-foot rats and that kind of thing.
When you're battling a giant rat, you're going to have to get a little
violent. It gets pretty hairy. So
I wonder if part of what makes this book kind of work for an adult audience as well as a YA audience is that the main character is obviously a young boy, but most of the other characters are adults.
Right.
There aren't that, this isn't kids interacting with a ton of other kids, which I think, and I'm not saying that, you know, you can't enjoy YA that is mainly kids, but I do think this does skew a little bit more adult just because, you know, there's only, there are other kids he interacts with, but they're not really the focus the way that kind of the adult characters are.
Sure. Nice. I think it's about time to get into spoilers.
All right, let's do it.
Okay, so we'll take the shackles off. Anything that you want to talk about, we can do.
Let's go straight to the ending now.
Okay, go for it.
No, but for real, what did you think of the ending? Because here is the thing. When I read this the first time, I was like, yeah, I'm into this. This time around, I don't, I like the ending, but I didn't like the ending with the Jack as much.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what about it didn't thrill you this time?
And this might have been from, I'm so sorry to keep bringing up the Jungle Book.
No, it's absolutely appropriate. So.
But in the Jungle Book, Shere Khan, the, you know, the big scary tiger, who's after Mowgli, his motives are really basic. He wanted to kill Mowgli as a kid because he wanted to eat him. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Mowgli grows up and he still wants to kill Mowgli because it's kind of a point of pride. He still thinks he should get to kill him. And then Mowgli is also has like vowed to kill him at this point, which there's references to that in this book as well. But I just felt like the whole secret cabal thing, I was like, really? Is that
right?
It was so overblown for something that is so personal. And also the idea, okay, so there's the secret cabal of people named Jack,
right?
And they want to kill this kid because it turns out there's a prophecy that this kid will kill them.
Right.
But like, they say they've been tracking his family for hundreds of years. Why did you not kill his family earlier? Like, what was, it bothered me. I was just like, well, okay.
The whole prophecy thing and the self-fulfilling prophecy really is what it ends up being, right? Because in coming after his family, they initiate the series of events that leads to the destruction of their order.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of basic storytelling. But for a young adult thing, I think it makes sense. So it certainly didn't bother me.
Okay. I love the ending of, you know, him going out into the world. Mm-hmm. And I think, and again, Jungle Book, I think that works a lot better than the Mowgli version, which is quite sad and kind of depressing because it's essentially Mowgli goes into the human world, essentially the Scarlet storyline, where the human world rejects him. Mm-hmm. So Mowgli goes in the human world, gets rejected by the human world because they think he's a magician, and he returns to the jungle, but doesn't want to be in the jungle anymore because they had rejected him too. So he just wanders alone forever with his four pack brothers. And then it says, oh, Mowgli eventually got married and had kids, but that's a story for adults. And I'm like, all right, Kipling, that was a weird inclusion. but yeah, I really love how Gaiman handles it, where it is a lot more kind of the classical coming of age story where he's not being rejected. It's just his time to go.
Yeah. You know? And just kind of the theme of you grow up and you move away from lots of times the groups of friends that you grew up with, that you think were always going to be friends. And, you know, part of it for me is that I grew up in Anchorage. And so, you know, I don't live in Anchorage anymore. And that makes it so that I don't interact with anyone from my childhood on a regular basis. Even with, you know, with social media, there's friends that I knew in grade school that we, you know, we like each other's posts sometimes. And once in a blue moon, I might see somebody who lives in like Washington, where I'm in Oregon, but you know, you grow up and you move on, and that's okay because you form your own new group.
Right.
But then how permanent are those new groups too? Because lots of times people move on from those. So.
Yeah. And I think he captures the bittersweetness of it really well.
Yes.
And also he has just the whole scene with Silas at the end. And Silas is 100% my favorite character in this book.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's so great. But yeah, just the whole, because I'm a sucker for the adopted dad trope. Like anytime there is a stern but secretly loving guy who unwillingly gets roped into raising a young child, I'm like, yes, I'm here for it.
Yes.
but yeah, just the whole scene with Silas at the end where he tells Bod that, you know, you might not see me again, but I'll see you. I'm like, oh, So
I even liked the little concession he made where Bod says to him, if you ever get in trouble, don't hesitate to call me, you know, and he says, I don't get into trouble. And then at the end he says, but if I ever do, I will be sure to call you. Because he knows that's what Bod needed to hear.
Right. Because he's a good dad, you guys.
I know, right? Yes. Get all blubbery. I liked the way the book played with tropes, kind of subverting tropes. Because, right, you have Silas who is, I don't think it's ever outright stated in the book that he's a vampire.
Right. But he's a vampire.
But you can totally tell he's a vampire.
Right.
And it took me a while to kind of glom onto that.
Yeah.
But the graphic novel makes it much more explicit because he's got the whole widow's peak and the red eyes, you know.
I was going to say, does he have like pointy teeth?
And a cape.
Oh, no.
But yeah, it's pretty obvious. But I think I was starting to get the impression that that's what he was. And then, you know, he swoops in and gets hit by the car. And I'm like, okay, yes, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. He's definitely something. And then at the end, I think he's like, okay, just in case you guys didn't get it at this point, he's like, they were reflected in the table, but Silas wasn't.
Exactly.
Like, he's a vampire, you guys.
Yeah. There's plenty of hints there to catch on to it. Yeah. I'm sure it's fun for a young reader to make that discovery. Especially since it's never explicitly stated. Even like the witch who was on the unconsecrated ground.
Liza.
Yes.
Liza Hempstock.
Yes.
Who's another great character.
I kept expecting, I thought, okay, something bad's going to happen here. You know, I felt like Crewman Guy from Galaxy Quest. And like, you know, they're cute now, but something's going to happen and they're going to get me, you know. But, you know, she saved his life at least once, maybe twice.
Yeah.
So
I think twice because there was the time in the where he was captured by the pawn shop dude.
Right.
And I think there was something at the end with her, wasn't there? Maybe I'm misremembering.
Yeah, I can't remember, but
something.
I know, you know, she's a heroic character.
Yeah. And I liked that it was a little awkward, but I did like that she kind of started having a crush on him by the end of it.
Yes.
Because that's such a weird situation.
Right.
But it was an interesting way to go with it, where it is like this. Because she's introduced and you're like, oh, witch, like this old lady. But then, you know, she was killed for stealing someone's man and probably was pretty young at the time, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, like this. And it also kind of flips that trope of ancient immortal dude falling in love with young mortal woman kind of around.
Yes, it does. And I liked, too, that there was the whole, you know, the injustice of the witch trials and that kind of stuff. And you're like, oh, you want to feel like, oh, that's righteous indignation that they execute an innocent woman. She's like, oh, no, I absolutely was a witch.
No, I was a witch. Like, that was accurate.
I cursed them all real good. So.
Got them.
Yeah. So the jacks of all trades, I guess, they were interesting. When I first started reading the book, I thought when it kept saying the man Jack, I thought, oh, it's Jack the Ripper. You know, is this set in like the, you know, the 18th century or something?
Right.
And then I think not too long afterwards, there's a mention of a cell phone. I'm like, nope. Okay. This is modern. but it took me a while to catch on to that. So
this is either modern or very anachronistic.
Yes. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's kind of steampunk, you know, it's a cell phone that has like a bellows on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think rereading this, they were probably my least favorite part of the book.
Okay.
And I mean, like they're necessary to have drama, to have like some sort of tension and something to have a plot. But again, it's that whole withholding thing that Gaiman does where he doesn't want to reveal all of his cards too early. But I just felt like for me, the payoff at the end wasn't.
Sure.
Like I felt like I would have been equally happy with this book if we didn't have the kind of side glances into their organization, you know, if they just showed up at the beginning and end and were mentioned by other characters kind of.
Yeah. I mean, some of that works into some of the poignancy for me, as a parent. I don't know if you have kids or if you're old enough to, but
no,
I always figure I'm much older than everybody that I podcast with, which isn't always true. I want to say Mrs. O'Leary, but that's a Percy Jackson thing.
Another great series.
Yeah. The werewolf.
Mrs. Lupescu?
Lupescu, yeah. Right.
Yeah, I was like,
there's a root word in there.
Werewolfy.
Yes. Wolf, yeah.
And then something Eastern European.
Yes. You know, she ends up laying down her life, essentially, to help eliminate the jacks. And, you know, as a parent, you kind of look at that and you're like, yeah, okay. You know, parents will go to any lengths to protect their children. And Silas is kind of the same way as well. You know, the whole, he gets hit by the car and Bod asks him, did that hurt?
Right.
Yes, it hurt. but I will heal. Going back to something you mentioned or you hinted at in the non-spoiler section was the ghoul gate. And this was the part where I'm like, I have no idea what I'm picturing here when they're on the way to Ghoulheim. And, but it's funny that you mentioned with the, that this is the part of the Jungle Book where it's the monkeys. And I can totally see that now because of the way they're, it describes the way they move, where they're, you know, swinging from one thing to the next.
They're like swinging and kind of clambering over stuff. And the book version is a little bit different than the various movie versions, which mainly are the Disney version and the live action Disney version and the other live action one that kind of is the Disney version.
That hasn't come out yet?
No. There's one from the, I want to say late 80s or early 90s.
The Jason Scott Lee one.
Which is essentially the same as the Disney version.
Right.
But in that they have, you know, King Louie who's in charge and whatever. In the book, the Bandarlog are just completely leaderless and don't follow the laws of the jungle and are this kind of force of chaos in the jungle.
Gotcha.
And I think, you know, the ghouls function in a very, very similar way where they can't be controlled. They can't be reasoned with. They have a logic, but it doesn't really follow the logic that everyone else is following. So they're they're very much playing by their own rules. And yeah, it's honestly, I think they were to me scarier than Jack because, you know, Jack at the end of the day is a human. And he has some powers, but he's still a human and you can follow his like thought process pretty easily, even if you don't always know his motivations until the end.
Definitely.
But yeah, the ghouls were very like, you don't know what they're going to do. And the part where they talk about how they, after they've rescued Bod and they're like, oh, they saved you multiple times because some of the ghouls were going to smash your head in with a rock while you were sleeping. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, where the best two options available to him were become a ghoul or be, you know, eaten killed and let to rot and then eat him.
Which is, I think, worse than just being eaten. Like the left to rot part. It's very, very creepy.
It's undignified.
Yeah.
I like the way they were named.
The
ghouls, you know, the 33rd president of the United States and the Archbishop of Canterbury. And I kept wondering, were these people actually those people or were they personalities that the ghouls took on? And I'm not sure.
I think Eileen, because I had the exact same question even when I was rereading this, because it is so, it's not clear. But I think they do say something about like how we got our, we told them the, something along the lines of like they told him a story of how we got our names or something like that, which, but because the names are titles, that could still be a living person, you know, how he became the 33rd president of the United States or whatever. But I lean towards their titles that they've adopted. And my personal headcanon is that they are titles from someone they ate. So
that could be
because that just adds a little extra level of weirdness to it. But I don't know. It definitely isn't explicit in the book at all. And it which makes it great, I think.
I like a person who uses the term headcanon, by the way.
So you're
OK. I also like the way the book would introduce characters in the graveyard by showing what their epitaph was.
Yes.
I thought that was really cool because there's, if you've ever visited a graveyard, you know,
there's some weird
epitaphs
ones.
Are creepy.
Yeah. The neighborhood I currently live in, it was actually originally a graveyard.
Oh,
it was like, there was another neighborhood and they built a graveyard here and they named the neighborhood after the graveyard and then eventually houses showed up. but yeah, so like, you know, there's a graveyard that's from the, late 1800s, I think, down the street from me, from where I live. And some of the inscriptions there are around this sort of inscription where they're very strange and very original versus, you know, I'm complaining about our modern graveyards and their use of RIP, but...
I liked particularly that there was Mother Slaughter, whose headstone had eroded to the point that it just said laugh.
Right. And it had confounded historians.
Yeah. I was wondering, because if you put Mother Slaughter together, all together, it looks like Mother's Laughter. And I didn't know if that was symbolic of something or if I'm just inventing, I'm going all Dan Brown on it or something. But
yeah, I think that since he draws attention to the fact that, you know, the grave... the epitaphs have been erased and changed over time. I think that, that makes sense to me to kind of squish them together as another sort of meaning.
Yeah.
And even if he didn't intend that, so what? Death of the author.
Exactly.
But yeah, I also think it's, I don't, and again, I don't know if he intended this or not, but in the Rudyard Kipling version, a lot of times when he introduces a character, it's the name and then like what the name means, because it's, you know, a different language that he's not exactly using, but approximating. So yeah, I think it's kind of similar to that in its function, where it's like you get the name and then kind of like a little tidbit about them, but not really that much to tell you too much about them, but just a quick glimpse into what they might be like.
You know, in earlier times, names had meaning, more meaning than they do now, right? Now we're just, we're like, well, that goes well with my last name. So, so that'll work. Or, you know, it's a family name, that kind of thing. But like, if you look like in the Bible or something, it'll show that, and therefore they called his name this. And you look in the footnote and it says, because this means, you know, red or something.
Esau, I think is red in the Bible,
Edom, which is another name for Esau. Yeah. I think Esau means hairy.
Oh, yep. Mixing up my Bible.
I can't remember. I may have them mixed up. I read it a couple months ago. So, anything else you want to talk about the book?
I feel like we've hit most of the high points. We talked about how great Silas is.
Yeah. I will say that Gaiman's prose is fantastic. You know, not all science fiction has great prose. And Gaiman really has kind of a poetic sensibility about his writing.
And I think a lot of science fiction, like to me at least, maybe I'm wrong about this because I'm not as into sci-fi as I've said, into fantasy, but I feel like modern sci-fi has become more poetic in its leanings versus kind of the 50s, 60s, where
it was about the idea.
Yeah, it was about the idea, and you want it to be very like specific and technical and not reveal a lot of emotions, which, you know, gets into some fun, you know, sexist stuff from like the early years where I can't remember which collection I read it in, but there's like a letter from the editor of this sci-fi magazine where they're like, usually we don't publish women's writings because they're very emotional, but...
That sounds about right.
Delightful.
Yes. Different time.
Different time.
It's funny because going back and, you know, in the course of this, I've done stuff all the way back into the 50s, you know, and there's categories of things that they get wrong. And some of it is just like predicting it's 2100 or something, but nobody has wireless communication, you know.
Yeah.
And other ones, it's statements like that, right? The original pilot of Star Trek had a woman who was the first officer. It was Majel Barrett. And Captain Pike says something like, I still can't get used to a woman on the bridge or something. Like, really?
Yeah. It's like, okay. And I really enjoy reading old sci-fi for that reason, like just to see kind of the stuff that they got wrong, which kind of, again, gets into the hate read element of things.
Yes.
But it's really fun.
Not so much of it here, though, and I enjoyed. I mean, this, it's more fantasy.
Yeah,
it's definitely fantasy.
And I mean, that gets into the whole. I think we can definitively say this is fantasy, but it does get into the whole like what is fantasy, what is sci-fi. It's kind of an exercise in futility trying to separate the two, because I mean, like hard sci-fi. When you look at the extremes, they're very, very different. But there's a lot of stuff in the middle, and
and a number of these titles are very genre bending too. Mm. Something like Lord of Light is science fiction with fantasy elements brought into it, right? Because it's technology used to create magical powers.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny, though, because I'm very comfortable saying science fiction is a broad umbrella. And there's all the way, you know, there's The Martian on one side, and there's stuff that's much less about the technical aspects.
Right.
Where with fantasy, I tend to, as someone who's not a huge fantasy fan, I think of, well, here's the fantasy that I've read. That's what fantasy is.
Right.
where it's really a broader tent as well.
Yeah, because you've got, you know, swords and sorcery on the one hand, and you've got like urban fantasy on the other, and it's a lot of stuff in between. And then you get into space opera, and who even knows what that counts as at this point.
Right, yeah. And like Star Wars, right? I look at that, I'm kind of like, that's space fantasy, right? Because it's magical powers in space. So.
Right. But it's like, I feel like it gets lumped in as sci-fi most of the time because it is in space and there are guns and starships and blowing things up. But yeah, I mean, the Force is a magical power, I think.
Unless midichlorians.
Except for the midichlorians. Yeah. The midichlorians. We can't forget the ever-important prequels.
Never forget. So one kind of final thing for me is talking about the themes, you know, of growing up and,
yeah.
And of a child growing up, you know, like I said, as a parent, my son's 16, right? We're looking at colleges and so reading this book and seeing him get older and lose touch with the younger ghosts because the ghosts never change. Right. And then starting to pack up and move away, you know, I admit it got me a little misty eyed thinking about my son, setting sail for different shores. Yeah. And so my wife and I are like, well, you know, if he goes to Stanford, then he's only an hour and a half plane flight away. So, yeah. So that hit me and it'll hit different people differently depending on, you know, if you're younger, if you're older, if you have children or not.
Yeah. I think I definitely related more to Bod in that moment being a child because I live in the same city that I have lived in my entire life and my parents are 20 minutes away from me. Right. So, gotcha. Yeah. So I'm very much like, oh gosh, like the whole growing up and leaving thing is something that I'm still coming to terms with sort
Absolutely.
Of. And you know, it doesn't have to be a physical leaving, but you know, I am still of the age where there's a lot more fluidity in my social life.
Well, any final thoughts on this book?
It's a good book. Probably going to have to read the graphic novel at some point.
Yeah, it was cheap the other day. And so I picked up, well, at least part one was cheap.
I saw that and I did not jump on it and I'm a fool.
The cool thing about it is different sections are actually drawn by different people. And so, it's not just one person's interpretation. So, so like Silas is represented slightly differently by the different artists. So different,
which is kind of perfect for a adaptation book. Like,
I definitely think it was worth a look, and it helped me to kind of refresh the story because it can be really tough to just, you know, to finish a book and immediately podcast about it without really getting to process it. And I've had to do that a couple times on enormous books. So
we do that pretty much every time we podcast because we procrastinate so badly on reading every book that we read.
Well, you do it every 2 weeks too. So that's a demanding schedule.
Yeah. And we're thinking about moving it up to once a week, but we're not sure. We're in flux at the moment in terms of our schedule.
Then as we start to move towards signing off, why don't you tell everybody about Hate Read?
Yeah. So if you guys want to check out Hate Read, we are on Twitter at Hate Read Cast, and we're also on all of the usual podcasting venues, iTunes, SoundCloud. I almost said Spotify. We're not on Spotify. Don't look for us on Spotify. SoundCloud, iTunes, Google, all that stuff. I'm also on Twitter. My handle is M, not Eliza, which is because somebody took the handle M Barger and their name was Eliza. So
it's probably E.M. Barger, right? Eliza M. Barger.
Yeah, probably. But bitterly, I named myself in honor of her.
That's awesome, actually. So did you follow her then?
She doesn't know, so don't like follow her and bother her.
Nice.
But yeah, that's where you guys can find me if you aren't annoyed by me at this point.
No, I don't think so.
And I promise I'll talk about I'll talk less about Jungle Book on my podcast. Nice.
So now, let's see, I probably will post this next weekend, and I'm thinking you guys have an episode coming out either this weekend or next weekend.
We do. We have an episode coming out this Monday, so it will have been up about a week by the time this goes up, and it's going to be on Charlie in the Great Glass Elevator.
Oh, okay.
By Roald Dahl. So that will be fun. I will say, though, so we're a pretty newish podcast, and we are both very unprofessional and don't know what we're doing. And we recorded some episodes in advance when we are still figuring stuff out. The audio quality is not great on this one. So if you guys want to listen to the one before that, that would be great. And then see if you like it.
Right. And that's the Me Before You.
Yeah, that was Me Before You. Or actually, if you guys check out, I'm sorry, I'm doing so much promo for myself right now.
No, go for it. That's what this section is about.
If you guys check out the Little House in the Big Woods.
That one is hilarious. That episode is great.
Very good episode.
Yeah.
Check that out.
I was mowing the, I think I was either mowing the lawn or doing some weeding or something. It felt appropriate to be doing yard work while listening to that one. So,
yeah.
And talking about
Old Man Shovel Hands.
Yes, Old Man Shovel Hands. I wasn't going to reveal that. I was going to use his actual name. Yeah, that was good stuff. Really, really enjoying what you guys are doing.
Thank you so much. It means a lot hearing that from somebody who like has actually been doing this and, you know, kind of seems to know what they're doing versus us.
Well, I've fooled you too, so.
Great.
I've been doing this one a little over a year.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is like episode 16, I think, something like that, because I just do one a month.
Yeah. Well, and I listened to like one episode and I was like, this seems like so much fun. I want to get on this podcast.
Nice. Perfect. I'm glad it worked out because I think this was a lot of fun. And I was worried at the outset. I'm like, I'm not sure what I have to say about this book. And right. So I always count on my guests to drive the conversation. You did a great job. So appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, Emma, I want to thank you again for being on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thank you again for having me.
And hopefully we'll talk to you down the line sometime. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Em. And I definitely recommend that you check out her podcast, Hate Read. She and her co-host have great chemistry together. They're very funny talking about these books that one of them expects the other one to hate. So definitely worth your time to check out. So if you'd like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at Hugo's Podcast or facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast. You can subscribe to us on Google Play, on Stitcher, on TuneIn Radio. Check out the website, hugospodcast.com, and you can see kind of the list of Hugo winners and if there's any that are upcoming. And if you would like to recommend a guest or be a guest yourself, just reach out to me if you'd like on any of those platforms. There's a contact form on the website, or you can shoot an email to me, feedback@hugospodcast.com. And that'd be great. And of course, if you would like to leave a review on any of those platforms, that would be fantastic. And I'd really appreciate that. And I think that's going to do it for this episode. So thank you so much for listening. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.